Elgar thought it was his greatest work, a musical depiction of a man facing his day of judgment. Based on a poem by the recently beatified John Henry Newman, The Dream of Gerontius can be heard this Thursday in Performance on 3, starting at 7.
And now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Nicole Krauss is a widely admired writer. The History of Love was an international bestseller, and her latest novel, Great House, has garnered glowing reviews. It's a haunting work, and in just some ways reminded me, Nicole, of the solitude of your first novel, Man Walks Into a Room, lost manuscripts, lost and found furniture. Can you see the connection?
I think probably all my life as a writer, I've been writing about not only solitude, but really this struggle to somehow transcend the barrier of the self, to somehow make oneself known to others. And it seems to me that's quite a complicated thing, and the effort is quite a laborious thing, but obviously I've dedicated my life to it.
Where do you think that comes from? I mean, from history, from antecedents, from your upbringing?
All of those things. I think as a child, I probably was quite lonely, and I grew up in a place that was somewhat remote. It wasn't an urban place, and I didn't feel that there were many others like me, and the nature of family life and all of those things. But I think from an early age, I felt that it was an enormous effort somehow to get past this barrier of the self. But I also had this enormous desire to do so. And naturally, I was an early reader, and I felt that this was the first way to do so. There was a way in which when I was reading, I felt, I mean, I can say this now, I didn't realize it as a child, but the barrier of oneself in the world becomes porous, and suddenly it's not only that the world is flooding into you, it's not only that you're arriving at experience you're too young to have, but you yourself are becoming, as you read these things, you are becoming these other people. And of course, as a writer, that only becomes more extreme.
And looming over all of this, as it always does when one's sort of one generation removed, is the sort of shadow of the Holocaust, isn't it?
Well, my grandparents were in various ways survivors. At the very least, all of their lives were sort of uprooted by history, by the war. They all were European. And I do think that this necessity for the second life, beginning again, over again, and having to deal with and absorb tremendous loss, of course, it had enormous psychological impact in my family, and one can barely even begin to, in a way, calculate all those reverberations. And yet I think in some way my work has involved that. I think, though, my particular interest as a writer is not really about being beholden to history or in some way calculating these particular aftershocks of historical or familial tragedy. I think I'm far more interested actually in what happens when you've lost something and how you're faced with a choice. You survive or you don't. And how do you survive? And this possibility for radical reinvention of the self. Okay, I've lost this enormous thing. I've lost a life, I've lost a home, a city, a parents, and I have to begin again. Who will I be? I mean, the most recent book, Great House, the title comes from, I think, the most beautiful stories in Jewish history, which is about this. The Jews have lost Jerusalem in the first century AD. Everything they've ever depended on, this city, this temple, is gone. Who will they be? What is a Jew without Jerusalem? And the answer to that question, which comes through this rabbi, Ben Zakkai, is a radical reinvention, which allows him to survive in the diaspora.
You were brought up on Long Island, I think. So I can imagine the kind of figures that, you know, you might have heard on the radio, on television, Bernstein, Glenn Gould. And Glenn Gould in particular, it seems to me, has a kind of link to your writing in that his playing has a strange sort of intimacy to it.
I think that's right. From a very young age, I think the first time I knew anything about Glenn Gould, something in me responded to him. And as the years have passed and I know more about and have listened to his music more and more, that has only increased, that passion. And in a way, this desire to understand him. But I think now perhaps it's more intellectualized than it once was. First of all, his relationship with his composer, with Bach, which somehow to find the composer that facilitated everything that he wanted to somehow verbalize, and the way, of course, that he was just so radically confident about reinterpreting these composers, bringing the Goldberg Variations, this dusty old piece, back to life. This incredible clarity of the voices that Gould got, which is just incomparable in a way. I think, you know, later, all these years later, now that I understand a little bit about myself and how my brain works and how I like to compose, as it were, I think this is always my instinct. How can you bring together various voices, and how can they remain distinct? How can they stand alone, but at the same time, absolutely speak to one another and have these cross references and enlarge each other and create a whole without ever dissolving into each other? And I think, you know, well, that's Bach, but that's how Gould plays Bach. I was just thinking about also how wonderful it is to watch him play. And in a way, I think I didn't fully understand his music until I actually was able to see films of his playing, because it's absolutely ecstatic. He loses himself in a way that is just so moving.
Playing that aria on the piano, I'm always stunned by how the line unfolds so effortlessly and yet so rightly.
Yes. He has a wonderful essay about the piece that I read recently, and he talks about, I mean, my sense of it when I left the piece was how difficult it is to understand how Bach did what he did. And he talks about, basically, he thinks of the Goldberg ego, that the piece has these relationships. The relationships aren't so straightforward as clear as other variations that came before, that there's a kind of unifying sentiment in a way.
And isn't it wonderful the way that first variation picks one up suddenly by the scruff of the neck? You've been allowed to kind of relax and luxuriate in that melody, and suddenly, woomph.
It's serene, and it has a kind of almost a seriousness, an aloofness. And then there's a sudden shock to the system of the first variation.
Glenn Gould played the aria and variation number one from Bach's Goldberg Variations, BWV 988. And actually, that was a recording made in 1955. Another musician, as I suggested earlier, Nicole Krauss, who you presumably heard and saw, was Leonard Bernstein.
Yes, I mean, I was aware of him, I suppose, growing up. But I don't think I really started to listen to him and was aware of his music and his conducting till later in my life. And again, he's somebody who, it's interesting with Gould, well, I guess I see various connections today. One has to do with watching him. What a thing it is to watch him conduct. I mean, he's so balletic. It's so beautiful. And again, this is kind of, you know, losing himself in the music. Something I also feel watching Gould play, I feel a kind of envy of what it must feel like to just embody the music so fully.
To have a dance partner, in a sense.
Yes. I thought of course, this beautiful speech that Bernstein gave in, was it 1962, the early 60s, when Gould was playing with the New York Philharmonic, and Bernstein felt that he didn't agree with the interpretation, though he loved Gould, though he so was impressed and admired this young musician. But he felt he had to stop the concert and tell people that, in fact, he needed to distance himself from the interpretation.
You are about to hear a rather, shall we say, unorthodox performance of the Brahms D minor concerto, a performance distinctly different from any I've ever heard, or even dreamt of, for that matter, in its remarkably broad tempi and its frequent departures from Brahms' dynamic indications. I cannot say I am in total agreement with Mr. Gould's conception. And this raises the interesting question, what am I doing conducting it? Because I am fascinated, glad to have the chance for a new look at this much-played work. Because, what's more, there are moments in Mr. Gould's performance that emerge with astonishing freshness and conviction. Thirdly, because we can all learn something from this extraordinary artist who is a thinking performer. And finally, because there is in music what Dimitri Mitropoulos used to call the sportive element, that factor of curiosity, adventure, experiment. And I can assure you that it has been an adventure this week, collaborating with Mr. Gould on this Brahms concerto.
I think what touches me most about that speech, what I find most amazing, is the generosity, which seems somewhat rare. Here you have these two great artists, and naturally there is going to be a kind of competitiveness. I mean, Bernstein and Gould, both pianists, both would-be composers, both would-be conductors, who one became a pianist and one the conductor. But this absolute generosity of saying, well, this is what art is.
And it is a generosity that's inspired by talent, actually, because Lenny was not without an ego.
Nor Gould.
Nor Gould, no. So, you know, I mean, obviously there was a huge mutual respect there. And I agree with you that that is very touching. Well, let's move to the conclusion of the Mahler Ninth Symphony, conducted by Bernstein in 1979. And I think there is another sort of correlation between music and writing, and in your writing in particular, and that's to do with space and indeed endings.
Yes. As far as endings go, I think my interest in the unresolved, in a way, is a way of looking at my love of the end of the smaller symphony, because I think as I get older as a writer, as I learn more and more, I become more interested in ambiguity. I'm more interested in posing the question and less interested in the answer. And of course, the unresolved involves great expanses in a way of silence, of uncertainty and doubt. And particularly in the last book, Great House, that book became about uncertainty. It became about the uncertainty of the process of never knowing how these parts were going to come together. It became about the uncertainty of the characters, but it also became about asking the reader to dwell for a while in the space it took to read this book, in uncertainty, not knowing so much, and perhaps in the end accepting a lack of resolution, which seems to me valuable because where else are we given to make a life? We have to commit to a self, we have to commit to a life, a profession, so many things without knowing for sure. And so I suppose as I get older, I kind of see more and more interest in the tension of that unknown, unresolved ending.
Thank you.
It really does disappear into nothingness, doesn't it?
Yes, it's kind of this last efforts at life, and then this giving in, this letting go, which seems strangely peaceful. Yeah.
The concluding moments of Mahler's Symphony No. 9, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, in that famous concert, the only time Bernstein actually worked with the orchestra, which was fortunately recorded in 1979. Now, there's a connection, Nicole Krauss, I think, between Bernstein and our next piece, even though it's a very different piece of music.
Yes, the next piece of music is by Bill Evans, and it's on Everybody Digs Bill Evans, which I think was his first album, if I'm not mistaken. But it was meant to be an introduction. He was trying to work out an introduction to a Bernstein song some other time, and then it became its own thing, piece.
Thank you.
Oh, in ways I can't describe, that piece somehow condenses all my feeling about my childhood, somehow growing up in the late 70s and early 80s in New York. And it's sort of inexplicable why, but I suppose it's such a nostalgic piece. It's a mood piece. And it's so introspective and meditative and thoughtful. And then it's so beautiful melodically, but then you have that dissonant right hand that begins to creep in. And I guess I'm also quite moved by improvisation, maybe again because of my own way of working.
Well, that was Peace, P-E-A-C-E-P-I-E-C-E, which Bill Evans recorded in 1958. We're going to hear next, Nicole Kraus, the whole of the third movement, the Molto Adagio of Beethoven's String Quartet in A minor, Opus 132, played by the Alban Berg Quartet. And this is a very happy choice, really, because there could be no better description of your feelings about it, well, at least your character's feelings, one should say, although I think they must be fairly close to yours, in Great House. And perhaps I could ask you to read this passage, which is almost self-explanatory.
Yes, absolutely. When I got home, S was still out. I put on Beethoven's String Quartet in A minor, a piece I'd always loved since a college boyfriend first played it for me in his dorm room. I still remember the knobs of his spine as he bent over the record player and slowly let the needle down. The third movement is one of the most moving passages ever written, and I've never listened to it without feeling as if I alone have been lifted up on the shoulders of some giant creature, touring the charred landscape of all human feeling. Like most music that affects me deeply, I would never listen to it while others were around, just as I would not pass on a book that I especially loved to another. I'm embarrassed to admit this, knowing that it reveals some essential lack or selfishness in my nature, and aware that it runs contrary to the instincts of most, whose passion for something leads them to want to share it, to ignite a similar passion in others, and that without the benefit of such enthusiasm, I would still be ignorant of many of the books and much of the music I love most. Not least of all, the third movement of Opus 132 that bore me up one spring night in 1967. But rather than an expansion, I've always felt a diminishment of my own pleasure when I've invited someone else to take part in it, a rupture in the intimacy I felt with the work, an invasion of privacy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do you feel, in a way, possibly, given what you read to us beforehand, that it's almost too intimate an experience to share?
I suppose that I do feel very much like that passage I read, as you guessed. And I think I've always felt that those things that I love most, I've had to work to find a way to share them, because maybe my first instinct is to kind of keep it to myself. And I thought, as I was listening to these choices, because you learn something about yourself when you have to make these selections, and I thought how interesting it is that I chose, given that passage I just read, I chose some very private pieces. I mean, the Mahler, you know, a man facing his death, really simply talking to himself in the end. And the Beethoven as well. It's intensely private. And the Bill Evans again. So, I don't know, and of course, the piece we're about to hear, the Reichuder, is filled with a kind of aloneness, in a sense. So maybe there's something, it's not only my way of loving the art that I love, but it's also the art that I love, which is so private.
We heard the third movement, the Molto Adagio, from Beethoven's String Quartet in A minor, opus 132, played by the Alban Berg Quartet. You mentioned, Nicole Krauss, how, in a sense, one was being taken on a kind of voyage across the landscape of humanity in that piece. And we're taken on a voyage across a landscape in this piece, too.
We are. And this is a piece that I first heard in a film that I loved very much, Paris, Texas, directed by Wim Wenders. And I saw the film just after I had myself crossed the United States for the first time in a car. I grew up, of course, as we said, in New York, and I went to Stanford in California. And to get there, I crossed the American West. And I was so impressed with this desert. All my life, we had gone to Europe. My family was from Europe. When we had vacation, we went back there. And now here I was kind of meeting this country that supposedly I come from.
And not only that, but at Stanford you met that rather remarkable man, Brodsky, Joseph Brodsky, who I think worked with you on your poetry.
I did meet him.
And I introduced you to all kinds of things like Calvino.
Like Calvino and like Zbigniew Herbert, a Polish poet who I still think of as one of my favorite poets. I mean, everything was waiting for me, in a way. I was about to learn so much, I was going to change so much, but there was this passage through the desert, and there was something terrifying about it, the sense of the possibility of disappearing into this space, and how insignificant, of course, one is looking up at this enormous... I mean, the stars are incredible when you're out in the desert. You're looking up at the universe, you know? So then I saw this film, and it's interesting how it percolated through time, because years passed. I thought I was going to be a poet. I wanted to be a poet. I graduated Stanford. I went to graduate school. I came back to New York, and one day I sat down and I thought, why don't I try to write a novel? I'd become sort of trapped in the poetry. And I thought, maybe just to find my freedom again, I could just try this different form and then, of course, go back to poetry. And strangely, the story that I sort of very quickly settled on is a story about a man who is found in the middle of the desert, in the Mojave Desert in Nevada, who is an amnesiac, who's lost his memory, and they have to begin to figure out who he is. And it turns out he's this English professor from Columbia University who has a wife in New York City, who one day got up from his desk and disappeared and simply lost 24 years of his memory, only had basically his childhood. So obviously this film, this experience, the desert, had this massive sort of impact on my imagination. And this Reichuder soundtrack, I think I listened to it more than anything else in those years. I listened to a lot of music, but this is the thing that sort of, on every mixtape I made for every friend, was this one track we're about to hear.
Raikuda. That slide guitar has a kind of hypnotic effect, doesn't it?
It does. And I had no idea that Cooter had based that on the Blind Willie Johnson, Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground. I mean, I listened to that for years before I realized that. And then I was told a beautiful story, which is that Blind Willie Johnson track was one of the few pieces of music chosen when they encoded those phonograph records that they sent off in the Voyager spacecrafts out into the universe, so that at some point or other, if aliens were to intercept them, they would have a sense of what human life was like.
Houston in 2 seconds. That was Raikuda, assisted by Jim Dickinson, from the soundtrack of Paris, Texas. Well, the next instrument, Nicole Kras, actually is rather unusual. I mean, slide guitar has become usual, but it wasn't not so long ago. But this instrument is unusual in popular song, even though it has a very strong folkloristic side to it.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to a lot of pop and folk and rock music, and I thought I had to at least put something in. And I love Joanna Newsom because her instrument is so improbable. Whoever thought that somebody could make a great, brilliant career as this kind of, folk pop artist with the harp? And the harp is so... She's absolutely unified with this instrument. It's as if it were some sort of prosthetic limb. I've watched her perform a couple of times, and it's hypnotic to watch her. I love her as a songwriter. I think her lyrics are just so intelligent, and they're sort of archaic, and they have all kinds of Baroque, strange influences. But I think what I love most about her, this is her third album, and with each album, she grows more ambitious. The songs become more complex. The lyrics become braver. This last album, I think, is 2 hours. I mean, it's a 3-CD album. And she's just totally, I mean, there's an amazing courage, I think, in her work. And, of course, she's incredibly gifted.
Hey, 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 the end is near. On a good day, you can see the end from but I won't turn back now, though the way is clear. I will stay for the remainder. I saw life and I called it mine. I saw it drawn so sweet and fine. And I had begun to fill in all the lines, right
on a good day, Joanna Newsom. Extraordinary, innocent kind of voice, Kate Bush-like almost. and just sort of plunges in.
And yet, yes, what I love most about her is that she's absolutely fearless.
Actually, those words are strangely appropriate for some of your writing. On a good day, you can see the end from here.
Why do you say that?
Because I think that there is something about the writing which looks both backwards and forwards in a funny way and takes one to a slightly uncomfortable place.
It does, and I think that this interest in occupying the struggle, writing these characters who are really, in a way, battling themselves, trying to understand what made them the way they are, facing their regrets and their failures. But I never want to do it simply for the sake of dragging us all down with them, but for this possibility of transcending those things.
Do you take a long time to write a novel?
I take about 2.5 years, but since I've only written 3, there's nothing regular about the process yet, but in general...
But yeah. Are you already on another one, then?
I'm just starting, but, I mean, I was going to say this a little when we were talking about the Bill Evans, but I really begin without any kind of plan or blueprint. I mean, I have no idea what I'm going to do, and it's just about beginning to find a voice that feels authentic and then adding another voice and adding another musical line to that and beginning to just follow things and become lost so that I have this chance to discover things.
Really. So you allow your intuition to a certain extent to guide you?
Not even to a certain extent. It's absolutely intuitive, and that goes on, well, for about a year and a half of the process. I mean, it's only towards the end that I begin to really understand the thematic connections, that these deep underground connections are allowed to sort of, in a way, come to light. But for a very long time, particularly with Great House, I was deliberately holding the strands of the narrative apart, trying to kind of sit with the tension of that so that the echoes could be, in a way, more subtle and more intuitive.
So rather, as with composition, there's a kind of gestational period where something is irritating under the surface. I always make the rather unpleasant analogy of a boil, but which is not a very good one in a way, but you feel something there. And it's quite frustrating in some ways because it's a time when you don't feel you're doing anything, but of course you are.
The analogy I use is of having an itch that you feel you need to scratch. And that's what I pursue. Sometimes it's just a desire to write about something, the bathing ponds in Hampstead Heath, I have no idea why, or a stone going through a window, and where does it land? Or a room which is deconstructed in one city and reassembled in another. And I have no idea why I want to write about these things. And it is frustrating not to know. But I've learned to have a kind of patience with that, to kind of sit with it and sit with it, because then something does happen. And I arrive at things that I could never have arrived at had I consciously tried to plan them out.
Nicole Krauss, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nicole Krauss was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the lawyer and crime writer Francis Fifield. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3.
Naima Yerby and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, a partnership that stretches back over the decades. Yerby returns to Scotland to conduct the orchestra in Performance on 3, a concert which includes a Shostakovich symphony dedicated to the city where Yerby learnt his craft. Leningrad. Tomorrow night's performance on 3 from 7 o'clock. On BBC Radio 3.
Splendid stuff. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the afternoon on Radio 3 today, and plenty more music to come. Painting and music come together, in fact, in a couple of minutes' time, when Andrew Graham Dixon is Catherine Bott's guest on the Early Music Show. They'll be exploring the many musical references to be found in Caravaggio's paintings as they chart his difficult life, and consider plenty of those pictures too, including that troublesome one, Amor Vincit Omnia. That's in a couple of minutes' time here on BBC Radio 3, after we've heard a summary of the news this lunchtime from David Cornett.
Opposition forces in Libya claim to have taken control of the oil town of Ras Lanouf and a hamlet 30 miles to the west. Earlier, a BBC correspondent was able to reach the town of Brega to confirm that the rebels had captured it from pro-Gaddafi forces. It follows continuing coalition airstrikes. France says its planes were in action late yesterday, hitting 7 Libyan aircraft in the west of the country. The Pope has called for talks in Libya to bring about a ceasefire, saying he's worried about the safety of civilians. He told pilgrims in St. Peter's Square in Rome that political and military leaders must use all diplomatic means available to work towards reconciliation. Water at one of the reactor buildings at the damaged Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan has tested 10 million times more radioactive than normal. Workers who've been trying to contain the fallout were evacuated from the building. The Nuclear Safety Agency says it's highly possible that the water is coming directly from the reactor itself. Reports from Syria say troops have taken control of key areas in the port city of Latakia, a day after violent anti-government demonstrations. It's reported that 10 members of the security forces and 2 gunmen have been killed. Syrian officials have blamed the violence on people trying to incite sectarian strife. Police have been accused of failing to do enough to protect businesses from the violence which broke out yesterday during and after the mass protest in London against government cuts. More than 200 people were arrested. The former Deputy Assistant Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Brian Paddock, says that with 4,500 officers on duty, police should have done more to protect property. Wiltshire police have charged a man with the murder of Sian O'Callaghan, the 22-year-old woman who disappeared after she left a nightclub in Swindon 8 days ago. Her body was found on Thursday in Oxfordshire. Christopher Halliwell, who's 47 and comes from Swindon, will appear before the town's magistrates tomorrow morning. And the weather, dry and bright, with sunny spells for many areas, but also fair amounts of cloud across the Midlands, and a few isolated showers are also likely during the afternoon. It'll stay mainly dry for most parts overnight, with clear spells. BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
And that was David Cornett. Well, we have music by Vivaldi, Coates and the Beatles in an hour from now in this week's selection of Radio 3 requests. And don't forget that a little later today we're live at the Roundhouse in Camden for a second visit to this weekend's Voices Now Festival in North London. Alad Jones hosts a live edition of the choir at 6:30. But next, this lunchtime, it's time to join Catherine Bott for today's edition of the Early Music Show.
It's late in the 12th century. We're in Provence, in the south of France, and Guiraud and Alamanda, both poets and musicians, are discussing the finer points of love between a man and a woman. Guiraud begins the debate, saying, "If I ask your advice, pretty friend Alamanda, oh, don't be hard on me. I'm following all the rules for being in love and getting nowhere with your mistress." And Alamanda replies, "For heaven's sake, man, you've just got to go along with whatever she wants." And he thought he was doing everything right.
Forte nel suo ira. kennt er ja bloß was Londa, mal gut kennt schade. Che vos nome è